Hi, welcome to another episode of Inside Golden State Politics. Here we are, back after our Thanksgiving break, and ready to go. I'm Bill Boyarsky, former city editor and columnist for the Los Angeles Times.
Some of us are ready to go, Bill. I'm Sherry Jeffy. I am a political analyst and self-styled media maven, coming to you from a lingering tryptophan haze. When you cook Thanksgiving dinner for one, you have an awful lot of leftovers to deal with. So I hope you all had as happy a Thanksgiving as was possible. Back to you, Bill, for the special news of this week.
We have a guest, Pilar Moraro. She's an independent bilingual journalist, contributing editor to Ethnic Media Services, and she's the producer of 187, The Rise of the Latino Vote on PBS, and she wrote the book Killing the American Dream, How Anti-Immigration Extremists Are Destroying the Nation. And we're going to talk today about one of the most misunderstood, overinterpreted, and important facets of the last election. And that is how that huge community grouped under the name Latino, even though it's too broad to be accurate, how they voted, the political behavior, and what does it mean for the Biden administration ahead. I was very interested in several aspects of it, but I was interested in how economic class played into it, how where your folks came from, how that all played into it. Laura, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, hi, thank you for inviting me to your show.
Hi, Pilar.
I'm a big fan of both of you. And this is a subject that has become sort of a favorite lately.
True.
And very little of what's been said in the mainstream media is, especially television, is very informative.
You think?
I mean, Latinos are indeed a group. And yes, it's hard to say all Latinos are this or that. But yes, we do have a lot of things in common. You know, we have a language in common. We have basic cultural traits, even though our different countries have different specific cultures. When it comes to Latinos in the United States or Latin American immigrants in the United States, historically, we have over the last few decades tended to vote Democratic. And that hasn't changed that much. It's gone up and down a little bit. You know, there's some Republicans that got a little bit more, like Ronald Reagan, George W. Bush, and there are others that got less. And the recent trends in the election are not really that different from that, you know, from that variation over the years. So nothing really special happened here.
If you looked at the media, that's not the impression you get. Tell me about that.
Well, you know, it can I say it pisses me off?
Sure, this is a podcast, not network television. That's okay. Why I love it so much.
Yeah, you can swear, Sherry, all you can,
yes.
All you want. I hope you do today. I want to hear it. You know, I guess a lot of the question centers around how Latinos in Florida and in certain parts of Texas voted, right?
Right.
But those, you know, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many experts in the, especially in the non-mainstream media and non-mainstream analysts, those are outliers that are explained by local and national realities that are, you know, close to those communities in those places, right? Before I go, you know, to talk a little bit about Florida and Texas, I want to say that I think the real story, there are two real stories here. One is the fact that Joe Biden won mostly because minorities the majority of people of color voted for him. Large majorities of Latinos, African Americans, Asians, Native Americans voted.
And women.
Okay, yeah, but we're talking about race.
I know, but and women.
Yes, voted for him. The other thing that I think is even more newsworthy is the increase in the minority vote. The increase in the Latino vote was tremendous. According to the exit polling and the election eve polling and all the polling that you do to kind of analyze what happened in the election, for the first time in U.S. history, Latinos turnout apparently reached comparable levels to the rates for white and Black Americans. Mm-hmm. That means that, according to that, 64% of the 32 million eligible Latino voters voted. That's compared to about 50% in previous elections. And that's a lot. That is an increase of 63% over 2016. Okay, so that's one thing. Asian Americans also. I don't want to get too much into that because I'm supposed to be talking about Latinos. So I'm Latino.
No, you can't talk about Latinos without talking about the context. So go for it.
Yeah. So, you know, Asian Americans also had a really good turnout. Increased in voting was 3.6 million Asian American more votes than 2016. So that's a lot. African Americans increased a little bit, not as much as Asians and not as much as Latinos, but that's probably because African Americans already vote a lot.
That's exactly right. And because the total population of Latinos and Asian Americans is increasing far more than that of African Americans. That's something we tend to forget.
For the first time, Latinos, you know, were the larger or the second
largest chunk
the
of
largest the ethnic mm-hmm. rather yeah. than yeah
other why, than white. Okay.
Why, you know, why was that? What happened? You know, I have my own ideas, and I don't know if, like, journalistic ideas, they're based on anecdote and observation, but when I was at the Times, and then later on when I wrote for several years for Truthdig, which was a progressive website. I covered immigration a lot, especially with Truthdig, and spent a lot of time in the immigration courts and talking to immigrant rights organizations and really getting thoroughly immersed in the cruelty of the government, of ICE. And I'll go back before Trump. They did call Obama the deporter-in-chief.
That's right.
And watching these misery of these families and the bureaucratic, mean, racist cruelty, I couldn't understand why everybody didn't vote against Trump. I don't know, but I'm probably carried away by my emotions. What do you think, Laura? What was your attitude?
About 70% of Latinos voted for Biden. It depends on depending on what exit poll or what calculation or analysis you look at, the Trump vote among Latinos was between 27% and 35%. That's not unusual.
It's a lot. Think
about
it.
It's not a lot. It's, I mean, George W. Bush got 40 plus percent. I mean, it's not. Look, you know, what I tell people when they ask me this is like, I mean, Latin America has a lot of right-wing people, too, you know?
That is an important point to discuss.
Yeah.
And in Florida, in particular, you have a chunk of Cuban Americans and the newest vote, Venezuelan Americans. Mm-hmm. My paisanos from Venezuela. Not all of which are pro-Trump, but a good number of them, and they are right now 75,000 registered voters. It's not a lot, but in Florida, where the elections are so tight, I mean, they can make a big difference, okay?
Anywhere where the elections are so tight, they can make a difference.
So, you know, but you have to keep in mind that everywhere else, you know, more than two out of three Latinos voted for Biden, you know, and even higher, you know, Latinos have, you know, helped him carry Arizona, you know, and Nevada, and you know, and you know, other states, you know, they were significant forces in other states, right? So in Florida, you have the Cuban and the Venezuelan equation, mm-hmm. and there was a lot of intense organizing, and also there was a lot of intense disinformation campaign in Florida targeting Venezuelans and Cubans, accusing Biden of being a socialist and saying that Trump is the only guy who can fix, you know, who can stand tall against socialism in Venezuela and Cuba. And a lot of people bought it, you know. I still, you know, see people in Venezuela who are getting these messages and who are convinced that there's a fraud in the election, and they're like, you know, rooting for Trump. Because why? Because the social media disinformation campaign targeted these populations. And it was so intense and so emotional that it really helped turn, you know, these Latino groups, you know, seriously against Biden. Even though Trump only got about 47% of the Latino vote in Florida, it was still enough to tilt, you know, the state.
Where were the Democrats when all of this was going on? That's what, I mean, what the Republicans did was to be admired as a political tactic. Organizations started a long time ago. They were hitting on economic grounds, which are, that's very important to anybody, regardless of who you are. The use of socialism, which you addressed, I mean, that was astonishing to me. I didn't understand it until you explained it to me, but it was extremely critical. The Democrats weren't there until about the last 2 weeks of the election.
Sherry, in Arizona, where the whole political debate was set by this bill, I think it was 1020.
It was 1070.
Yeah, where it in effect gave law enforcement the right to stop anyone with a dark skin, anyone, and ask for their papers and to tyrannize them. And it was the product of this Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who led the anti-immigrant feeling in Arizona. And Arizona went Democratic.
Yeah.
And the reason people say, one of the reasons it went Democratic is that Latinos were energized by Sheriff Joe and his tyranny.
Well, not just energized, but there was organizing on the, you
That's
know, and
key.
This organizing comes from 2010, from the organizing against Arpaio and Arizona and the Arizona law 1070, SB 1070 or whatever the name was. So these are organizers on the ground. They did have support of the Democratic Party, but I think they're mostly local organizers. So that had a big influence there. In Florida, I really don't know. There's a lot of talk that the Democrats didn't do enough. But also, you have to keep in mind that the other big group in Florida is the Puerto Ricans. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the other things that I thought was interesting, two of the political leaders of Puerto Rico, who actually cannot vote in the States. I mean, you can only vote as a Puerto Rican if you live in the mainland. You cannot vote for president if you live in the island. They supported Trump. And so that might have influenced, you know, the turnout of Puerto Ricans.
You know, that's so amazing to me. He treated the disaster in Puerto Rico with such contempt. Remember throwing out paper towels and all of that.
Yeah.
I guess what it taught me is that you'll never figure out the voter.
That's true.
You can spend a lot of time on it.
That's the challenge of democracy. That's exactly it.
The other thing I wanted to say was about Texas. There, you know, those two counties near the border that are majority Latino, that where Trump had a better, you know, vote. He had like 40%+ of Latinos there. I mean, and he increased his rate of Latino vote. I've been reading a lot about it. And the one thing that happened is that that area has become militarized, and a lot of investment at the border and all industries having to do with the border, from the border patrol to everything else. So, and also there's been an increase of illegal immigration in that area. So Texan Latinos have always been more conservative, but at the same time, if you live at the border and you work in the industry of building the wall and the border patrol and all that, you tend to be more conservative as well. But if you go to the main cities in Texas, Latinos, you know, Biden, wiped the floor with Trump, with Latinos. So I guess my question to you guys is, why are we talking about the Latino vote if the people who elected Donald Trump were whites?
Well, I think that Trump's base has always been racist. You know, that's, you know, you can talk to me about beleaguered, you know, white working class, and you can have reporters go into coffee shops and, you know, taverns all through the Midwest, and people tell you their sad stories. But I thought from the very beginning, before he became president, I thought race was at the heart of it. And, you know, race is the great affliction of American society, and that's what elected him. Now, I know a lot of people don't agree with me, and they say that I'm, you know, I'm unsympathetic and I'm an elitist and I don't understand working class people. And I think that's a cop-out. I understand people. So that's what I think. That's my opinion of the Trump movement.
So why are we talking about the Latino voter when it was whites who elected Donald Trump? A, we knew, like, you know, whites are the larger electorate. Why bother to talk about that? The key is...
But what's the matter with white women?
Wait, I haven't finished. Shut up, Pilar. Now I've totally forgotten my incredible point. It's particularly... In 2020, the margins were important. It was groups other than whites, by and large, who had the potential of swinging the vote, of swinging a state from one candidate to another. That's why, at least for me, what happened with not only the Latino vote, but the votes of other smaller voting groups, including women with a college education, Black women, were so important to look at in this election. The second reason for me is I think that the mainstream media made a hash of their coverage of the Latino community. Oh, they took joy in being able to talk about this monolith, this sleeping giant. And it doesn't take into account every other factor that influenced their voting, as
Look,
well
Sherry,
as those factors.
Sherry, you know, having done that for a living,
other voting.
Spent my whole life in that business. I have to say that the reason for that poor coverage is that the mainstream media, the large organizations, everybody but websites and all of that, and brilliant podcasts like our own, right? We always take the simplistic route.
Particularly
so,
with our special
there you
guest
are,
today.
This reporter, hey, boss, I got a hell of a story. And then the boss is really busy. And the boss wants it broken down. Okay, what's it about? Latinos. Oh, okay. Latinos pro-Trump, pro-Biden. Well, boss, it's more complicated than that. You know, you got all these nuances and all of that. And pretty soon the boss gets sick of you and says, get out of here. I'll give the story to someone else. Jesus.
And he starts going, what's the lead? What's the lead?
What's the headline?
Good point. Good point.
And, and the other reason is there's not enough.
That's very true, Laura. When I was city editor, not through any great brilliance of my own, but the city desk, we had three Latinos as assistant city editors. In the city desk when I was city editor. And they were all quite great. And we would discuss things. And from those discussions would come stories. To my right was Stephanie Chavez, who's the daughter of a Los Angeles fire captain and comes from, conservative background. And then there was Frank Sotomayor over there, who was, a Chicano from when Chicanos were starting and all of that. And I just, without going into great lengths, we had a story that a reporter who was an African-American person brought in from a high school out in the San Gabriel Valley about conflict between Latinos and Armenians. That's a story, Armenians, Latinos. I can understand that. And we were talking about it. And Frank said, that's not the way it is. He says, my son goes to that high school. It's much more complicated. And he explained the dynamics of that high school and that a Latina would be dating an Armenian guy. And her father would say, if I see that guy around the house, I'll kill him. And, oh, okay, Papa. And they'd sneak off. And he says, and they're on the same teams. They're in the same place. That's just complicated. Well, that's what you get when you have a newsroom that reflects the community.
Right. I feel that it's this whole thing about, covering this supposed shift from Latinos to Trump. I say it's supposed because it's not really a shift. It's a little bit of a cop out.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, it's almost like they want to blame Trump on us.
I hadn't thought of it that way before, but it makes sense.
Let me send the message to white people. He's your guy, okay?
Not mine.
Okay.
Another white Latino. I wanted to ask you, how do you feel personally? How did you feel personally, as a journalist, but also as a person, about Trump's policies of family separation, deportation, rejection of DACA, all of those things? How did you feel personally?
Well, of course, I felt horribly. I covered immigration at La Opinión for a long time, and I was aware of what Obama did. But I was definitely afraid, when the night of 2016, I was in the newsroom, still worked at L'Opinion, and we heard that Trump had won. I was honestly really afraid because I knew he was a racist. Everyone in my newsroom knew he was a racist, and we called him a racist, which is another thing. The mainstream media took forever to call him a racist, to call him a liar. I mean, all those things that all of us in the ethnic media were already calling him for years, okay? So, but I knew he was gonna be awful. And when he announced when Jeff Sessions was named, Attorney General, I thought, oh my God, this is just gonna be a bloodbath. Because that, Jeff Sessions is basically a typical Southern racist, right? So when they announced this no tolerance, zero tolerance thing at the border, where they would catch the family and prosecute the parents and separate the families, we knew it was going to be a big disaster. The increase in unaccompanied minors and families coming from Central America was not new to the Trump administration. It started in 2013 under Obama. It had really nothing to do with Obama. It had to do with local issues in Central America. Maybe some longer historical trends that where the United States had something to do as well. But that's just too much into the past. So let's say that there are issues in Central America: poverty, criminality, mafias, et cetera, gangs that prey on these people. I've interviewed many of them, so I know why they fled. But they really wanted to inflict pain on this community. Now, I got to say, Donald Trump only consolidated and augmented what had been the sort of the intention of the Republican Party for a long time. You know, this self-deportation. Inflict pain so people will stop coming and self-deport. This is not new to Trump. He just essentially implemented it to its maximum. But this has, this is what my book was about. You know, since 1994, the Proposition 187 passed in California, it spread to the country like a cancer, this wave of anti-immigrant stuff. And then it spread to the states. And then, you know, and we had new federal laws and this and that. And the Republican Party got more and more racist to the point where they produced a Donald Trump. So how I felt was that, how I feel right now, honestly, is that this is not the country that I wanted to be in, you know, 34 years after I immigrated here. Mm-hmm. It's very sad to see this country in this, it's very sad to see the racism. Obviously, we went through the whole, you know,
it's
Black
always
Matter.
Easier, though.
It's only, yes, but it goes through waves, right? The immigration stuff goes through waves. It's always been there. But, you know, when I came here in 1986, that was the year that the amnesty law passed. So you had Ronald Reagan, a Republican, and a bipartisan bill passed by Congress giving amnesty to 3 million people. You know, that never happened again.
But this is this is where you can point out that Ronald Reagan was a Californian. The perspective among Californians, despite 187, despite affirmative action 209, and despite Proposition 16 this year, and that's a conundrum I'm not yet really ready to figure out. But he related to, he knew about Latinos. They were a part of his community too. And that's what made the difference. That's a big difference between Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump on the issue of immigration and racism for that.
And I don't think that Ronald Reagan, who I knew, I don't think he was a racist. And I think that Donald Trump is a racist. And that's a
I don't know either. I don't think at all.
Well, this has been really a great discussion. Pilar, thank you very much for being our guest. And I want to thank Nancy Boyarsky, our producer director. And Sherry, we'll get together and talk next week. Bye-bye.